everyone. Welcome back to Stories from the Influencer Economy for episode number 62. My guest is Alan Sepinwall of HitFix.com and formerly of the New Jersey Star-Ledger. Really glad that you're here for this episode. Want to make sure you stick around until the end, where Alan talks about his self-publishing a New York Times top 10 book, The Revolution Was Televised, and goes into some history of his own of writing pre-social media, pre-Twitter. He was writing on the web before the word blog even existed. So imagine that time period. Also want to say that this episode is brought to you by my panel at South by Southwest. I bought my own advertisement. So if you'd like to support me, I'm taking part of a panel, hopefully, at South by Southwest Interactive this year with former podcast guests Tom Merritt and Jamel Hill, who were both fantastic on the show, and we're doing a potential panel, which is going to be called Podcasting Grown Up, Community and Monetization, and going to dive into Jamel's work at ESPN and how she works at a big network as a reporter and also has grown her following as a podcaster, and Tom's background with Daily Tech News Show and being independent and actually having an ad-free show and network for podcasting. So if you check in the description of these episodes on SoundCloud and iTunes and the blog, you'll find the link to South by Southwest panel picker. So again, I bought my own ad, so please, if you support me, that would be awesome. And without further ado, Alan Sepinwall for episode number 62. Really excited for my guest today. It's Alan Sepinwall from HitFix.com. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Wanted to give a quick intro based on your history as a writer, as a podcaster and author. So right now you're at HitFix. You're writing a column called What's Alan Watching? And I love that because I know that you started writing back in college when you were at UPenn and covering NYPD Blue. Back in the day before the internet, this is in the 90s, you know, wasn't really what it is today. And you built your passion around writing. And over time, you started writing at the Star-Ledger, and moreover, you self-published a book which became a New York Times bestseller, The Revolution Was Televised. And I'm a big fan. I'm a writer as well. I haven't published my book yet. I'm in the process of talking to agents as well as considering self-publishing, so I would love to get into that later. But for starters, it would be great to hear about how you wound up at HitFix and really what it was like writing on the web back in the 90s on a college server.
Yeah, that was one of several instances of being in the right place at the right time. I came to UPenn in the fall of 92. In the spring of that year, they decided to give not just the engineering students, but the entire student body email accounts. I waited online for mine right behind Steve Glass, the fabulist who was my editor at the college paper at the time.
This is the New Republic?
Yes. Steve and I got our email accounts together. I went, I started surfing around the internet. I discovered the Usenet news groups, which were, I guess, the blogs or the message boards of their day. They still exist. But I just became, like, that fall, I became really hooked on the NYPD Blue show, and that's an odd thing for a college sophomore to be into. And so it wasn't like I could find a lot of friends around the campus who wanted to talk about it. So I found people online. I would go to rec.arts.tv to talk about it. And one night at about 3 a.m, I think, someone posted, "Hey, I missed tonight's episode. I'm not going to be able to see it before next week. Can somebody tell me what happened?" And I was up and had nothing else to do. And so I wrote a recap of it. And a bunch of people said, "Hey, that's really good." And so that became a thing I did first on Rec Arts TV, then on Alt TV NYPD Blue when the Alt family opened up. And I just would do them for the news group. At a certain point, the recap started to be combined with commentary. Eventually, I set up my own website. It's still out there on the Penn servers. It looks really, really dated and primitive. And I don't think my HTML coding skills have advanced from around 1995 or so. But I did that, and when I was getting ready to graduate, I included it when I sent out my clip package to different newspapers I was trying to get a job with. I included not only clips from the Penn student paper, but also just printouts of things from the website, and that caught the fancy of the features editor at the Star-Ledger. This was the spring of 96. The internet was still new. She was smart enough, Susan Olds, to know that this is where things were going. I seemed to have some sense of what was happening on the internet. And so she brought me in, and a month later, it turned out that the Star Ledger's longtime, you know, 40 years plus TV critic couldn't go to the TV Critics Association press tour in California, and so they decided to send me. So within a month of graduating college, I was a full-time TV critic.
So this is incredible for many reasons.
Yes.
One is Jonah Carey was on the show. I posted it this week. He was talking about Fangraphs, the baseball website, and that started as a rec website as well.
Yeah, Rec Sport Baseball. I would go there, and people would make fun of me for thinking Derek Jeter was good on defense.
Oh, you grew up in New Jersey then? Are you a Yankees fan?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so you're not a bandwagoner. That's okay.
Nope.
I feel like I have all these friends that moved to New York, and suddenly they're like, oh, I love the Yankees. You know, I've loved them for the last 8 years since they've won 6 World Series.
No. My mom was a Yankee fan. My sister was a Yankee fan. She actually wound up in third or fourth grade writing a guest editorial for the New York Times sports section that I think Murray Chass arranged for her to publish back when Murray was a much less cranky individual than he is now.
So is she a writer then?
No, she's a college professor, but at the time she was really hardcore into baseball, and I think she wrote a letter to the editor about the way that they were listing the standings, and they were so intrigued by the idea of a third or fourth grade girl loving baseball that they had her write a thing.
Oh, that's awesome.
There are two framed newspaper clippings on the wall of my mother's study. One is that for my sister. One is the first thing I wrote as a summer intern for the New York Post, which was about, I think, Rec Sport Basketball Pro. So it goes back to Usenet.
I love it. And I think that there's something here that I'm finding for the book and the research is people that are succeeding now in this new world where they're creating their own communities and followings, they're embracing technology early. Would you ever have considered yourself a techie or a technology enthusiast back in the 90s?
I mean, I liked computers, but I liked them more for what they were giving me access to than for the computers themselves. I was friends with a lot of Penn engineering students, and they would often have to talk me through a lot of the equipment stuff, the hardware and the software stuff. But once I figured out how to use it, I just liked being exposed to all these people who shared the same interests that I did, which was a really frustrating thing as a pop culture obsessed teenager in the 80s and early 90s, because I could never find anyone who was into the same stuff I was.
And so at that point, you know, the internet is where you're meeting people with common interests. So you're essentially social networking ahead of Friendster, MySpace, any sort of platform that we know. Like back in the day, these weren't common habits.
Yeah, so some of my best and closest and longest lasting friendships come from a listserv I was on for the Homicide TV show on NBC. And, you know, people were at my wedding who were on that listserv. It's just, yes, that is the way we were social networking back then. It was fairly primitive, but it was the same basic idea.
So do you think that you were... Like, so you obviously define the category currently of, you know, TV recaps, which has become an industry of itself.
Yeah.
And do you think you were, like, if we go back to those rec forums, that you had one of the first online TV recaps, or were there other people doing
it? No, there were other people doing it before. And part of the way I wound up structuring what I did after a while, there was a guy named Tim Lynch, who was a math professor, I think, at Caltech, who would recap every episode of Star Trek The Next Generation and then Deep Space Nine, and I think for a little while Voyager. And I read his stuff, and I liked the way he did it, and I said, all right, I can do that. There was a lot of that going on in the science fiction community because, as usual, that community is always out ahead on technology stuff. So there was a bunch of Star Trek recappers, some Babylon 5 recappers, things like that. But there wasn't anybody really doing it at that time for more mainstream kind of shows like NYPD Blue. And in a little while after I started doing it, obviously, Sarah Bunting and Tara Ariano started up Dawson's Rap, which became Mighty Big TV and then became Television Without Pity. So I think we all were having the same idea at roughly the same time.
I love it, by the way, that your wedding had a friend from a listserv. I mean, that's classic, because back then people weren't really understanding the power of the web. So when you had your website, What's Alan's Watching, what's the domain? Is that still the name?
It's the domain right now. It's hitfix.com/What's Alan Watching. I had a blog on Blogspot that we can talk about, but it's just this is something that's set up at Hitfix. The name actually comes from an unsold pilot that Eddie Murphy produced in the late 80s with Corin Nemec as a TV-obsessed kid named Alan. And as a TV-obsessed kid named Alan, I could relate, and it just worked out well as the title of what I was trying to do.
Wait, what's it called?
What's Alan Watching? That's the name of the show.
And that's the name of the website.com?
No, it's hitfix.com/What's Alan.
But the original one?
The original one was seppenwall.blogspot.com.
Oh, wow, you're old school.
Yep.
Okay, cool. And then I love it. I mean, this is the epitome of, you know, people today that are, you know, coming ahead and launching their own media properties and brands. And now you're at HitFix, which for HitFix, how much of what you did for the Star Ledger do you think mattered versus how much online work you were doing? And also, more importantly, when you had your website up on Blogspot, did you have a lot of community interaction in the forums? And did you have an email list? Like, how did you grow the audience?
The audience grew as kind of a fluke. I started it in October of 2005, and I told a bunch of other fellow TV critics and friends I was doing it. It was born in part out of a desire to get back to that NYPD Blue stuff, you know, and that the direct interaction that I hadn't had in a while as a newspaper TV critic, but also just based on the fact that I would spend about 2 hours every morning at the job on the phone with other TV critics talking about what we had watched last night. And at a certain point, I thought, hey, I can just write about that. And so it turned into that. But I was really writing into the void. If you go back and you look at those early posts, there are almost never any comments. The handful that there are from friends from that homicide listserv who, you know, who are just hanging out. And then one day in, I think, December of that year, I got the schedule for the TV Critics Press Tour in January. And NBC on their schedule announced that they were doing a farewell press conference for The West Wing. And they said that Aaron Sorkin and Tommy Schlamme, who had left the show several years earlier, the executive producers, were going to be on the panel. And I thought, hey, that's interesting. And so I just wrote up a quick post saying, hey, guess who's coming to press tour? And somehow that went viral, or at least as viral as things could go in 05. And it started getting picked up in weird places. I think USA Today's Pop Candy site put in a link to it. Some other bloggers came by, and suddenly I had a community, and it was a small one, but people kept linking to it, and I had commenters, and I interacted with them, and it grew from there.
And so do you still see commenters on HitFix website, or do you see any crossover from, you know, 10, 15 years ago, people that still read you and still interact with you?
Yes, I mean, some of it's changed and some people have moved on, but there are still some regulars who I know, you know, who I've been seeing their names for, you know, 9, 10 years now.
You're like a bartender, and you're serving the drinks to the customers, and sometimes you get some turnover, other times you get regulars.
And it's been nice. And, you know, one of the best things, especially in the early days of that blog, was the commenters were smarter than me a lot of the times. They had more interesting things to say than I did. And I would often get hear from other people reading the blog saying, wow, how do you have such good commenters? You read comments every other place on the internet, and everyone's a stupid moron, you know, with bad manners. And that was really not the case. And I worked very hard to maintain that level. And I sort of instituted a set of rules about what you can and can't say and what you can and can't do. And if you violated them, I would delete the comments and, you know, publicly say I was deleting them. And that seemed to really work. And I've tried to do it as much as I can on HitFix as well. The audience is much bigger now than it was before, so it's harder to police it. But I do the best that I can.
So what are some comments that you remember that are smart or inflammatory?
One of the really smart ones was in the second or the third season of Mad Men, Don is at a party and he doesn't feel like he fits in with any of the rich people. And so he disappears into another bar at the country club and he winds up running into someone else who is fleeing his own party. And they become friends, and the guy says his name is Connie, and he's from some town in Arizona. And they get to talking, and within two or three comments on my blog, people are like, that's Conrad Hilton. That's the town that Conrad Hilton is from. That's clearly him. And so half a season before that character reappeared and said, hi, I'm Conrad Hilton, my readers had figured that out, and I thought that was pretty cool. Where it goes bad is when people start insulting each other, where they decide, like, ad hominem attacks. When I wrote about the 2008 election, not even about the election, just about SNL that year, because Tina Fey was doing all the Sarah Palin impressions, it got so ugly that at a certain point I said, you know what, we're not talking about politics anymore ever on the blog. You know, if we're discussing something with a political bent, you can't actually discuss the policy behind it, or I'm just going to delete that. I don't care. People on both sides are just idiots about it.
That's like when you see your friend on Facebook post something about politics, and then their right-wing friends take on the left-wing friends, and the left-wing friends take on the middle friends, and suddenly that friend writes, the original friend writes, yeah, note to self, no more talk about politics on Facebook.
Yeah, that becomes one of those where I've certain friends who I love dearly, and I make sure that they do not appear in my timeline.
Yeah, hide.
Yep.
Well, that's awesome. So you talk about, you know, you've written for Mad Men. I loved your Breaking Bad recaps. And how did you end up, you know, going to HitFix, and how did they end up discovering? Was it through your website, do you think?
Well, no, it's two things. One,
and by the way, I'm a big fan of HitFix. So,
oh, thank
you. One of my old colleagues from Machinima, Matt Perez, is there.
I was at Star Ledger, at the Star Ledger, at a really golden period for that newspaper. We had a lot of money. We had an incredible murderer's row of staff. Matt Zollersites, who's now the TV critic at New York Magazine, he and I were on the beat together, which would never happen today, to have two people that good on one beat. So a lot of good stuff was going on, and it was also at the time that The Sopranos came on, and so that became a huge thing for us because we were sort of the hometown newspaper of The Sopranos, and we were embedded in there, and when the show ended, I was the only reporter who David Chase spoke to the next day, and things like that. So that was good, but it was really the blog more than anything else that made me known beyond the sphere of New Jersey. And I started hearing from people all over the country and then all over the world in a way that I never had when I was writing online or just writing for the Ledger or writing for the Ledger's website. So that definitely raised my profile an enormous degree. But in the specific case of HitFix, I had also gone to the University of Pennsylvania with Dan Feinberg, one of our top editors and my partner on the TV beat and in the podcast that we do. And so when they were looking to expand the scope of their own TV coverage, Dan reached out to me and said, "Hey, are you interested?" And it had been a bad time at the Star Ledger. Newspapers were not in great shape, have gotten in worse shape since then. And the Ledger in particular had been really badly hit. A lot of people had taken buyouts. A lot of other people had left. And it was a lot of trying to do more with less that at a certain point I said, all right, I'm ready to get out and do something else. And this offer came along at the perfect time.
What year was that?
2010.
Okay.
And so now you do you work from home or do you have an office in New Jersey?
I have an office in New Jersey. My son was born about a month before I started at HitFix. And so for a while, because everyone else in HitFix is pretty much in Los Angeles, I tried to work from home and it just really didn't work out. If you don't have an enormous house and you have small children, it's just impossible to get anything done. And so we arranged for me to rent a couple different office spaces, you know, not too far from where I live. And I bounce around and I'm in one now and maybe going to another one soon. And it's an excuse to get out of the house, get dressed, have some privacy, and really focus on what I do.
Yeah, my thing, I equally have worked from home and have a co-working space here in LA, but I used to work with a company in London, so I would just shower and put a nice collared shirt on, and I could be wearing shorts or whatever because I would Skype.
Yeah.
And there is something to be said for just sort of putting yourself together.
Yes. No, I
taking things a bit more professionally.
Yeah, even when I was at the Star Ledger, I was not, you know, before we had kids, I was never as productive when I was working from home as I was when I would go into the office.
Totally. And so, and now that you're at HitFix, you've expanded, you have a podcast.
Like, the podcast actually started right before I left the Star Ledger and before I even knew that I was coming to HitFix. It was just Dan and I looked at the landscape and said, hey, you know, we talked on the phone for like at least an hour every day about TV. Let's just turn this into a podcast. We both wound up at HitFix together.
That's awesome. And then now that you're a bit of a, you have a lot of fingers in different things. I would say, you know, your content career, like you've helped define and shape this category of TV recaps. You define your niche early. These are all characteristics that I see a lot. And people like Bill Simmons, you know, even Jonah Carey writing about baseball and statistics. Like when you actually, I actually originally heard of you when I read the television or your book, The Revolution Was Televised, through Bill Simmons' podcast. Do you think there's like a Bill Simmons bump, or how would you explain?
No, there's absolutely been a Bill Simmons bump. I interviewed him around the time that 30 for 30 was debuting, and he knew who I was, and he said, "Hey, you should come on the podcast." And just, you know, if you look at the bump in my Twitter followers every time I would appear on the BS report after that, and the number of times I hear from people saying, "I first heard of you on, you know, on Simmons' podcast," is absolutely the case that, you know, knowing him as, you know, as tenuously as I know him has been very good for my career.
And you just met him through like the internet, like you know one another?
I was at the TV Critics Press Tour and they were doing a press conference for 30 for 30. And I said, "Hey, I want to interview Simmons." And the ESPN publicist set it up and we sat down in a lounge in the hotel. And, you know, we talked about that and we talked about TV in general. And he's, you know, he made me a semi-regular on the podcast for a while, which was nice.
Yeah, I remember that. That was great. And so I heard through your, actually, so I got your book on my iPad. I was working with the same company in London. I sadly lost my iPad on the plane, and so I didn't make it all the way through your book. It's a first world problem, right? Flying to London with an iPad that you lose. But reading about your book in general and how you marketed it, and me as someone who's an aspiring author, it sounded like you got this really good New York Times review.
Yes.
That helped you propel your book into the next level. So would love for you if you could explain your book, but also talk about the process. Like, did you want to self-publish from the beginning, or did you actually go to publishers at first?
No, I went to publishers at first. The revolution was televised. The idea is it's a history of the period of television that I was chronicling, starting around 99 with The Sopranos, with The Wire, with Deadwood, with a lot of these other cable shows and then network shows like Lost and Friday Night Lights that really transformed the idea of what was possible on TV, put television on equal footing with the movies and with other art forms in terms of respectability and ambition, and just, you know, featuring interviews with a lot of the creators and showrunners I had gotten to know over the years in covering these shows when they were on. And the idea was I took this around to publishers. I had a literary agent who'd reached out to me, said, "Hey, have you ever thought about writing a book?" And I said, "Yes." And this was my idea. And we went around and we didn't really have a lot of luck in terms of interest. And I think part of it was the literary community doesn't necessarily know TV that well. Part of it was, it turned out later on, and I didn't find this out until basically I was close to publishing, there was a similar book in the works at a publisher. And so nobody else necessarily wanted to touch mine. And just people were skeptical that there would be an audience for this. And so I got one offer. It was a pretty lowball offer. I sensed not a lot of enthusiasm from that publisher about it. The editor liked it, but I could tell his bosses didn't. And they wanted it to change enough that that's not what I wanted to do. And I knew people who had self-published, and I knew that now it was pretty easy to not only self-publish for digital, but for print. You know, Amazon had this print-on-demand program that I found really interesting, and I owned a couple of books made by it, and they seemed indistinguishable from traditionally produced books I did. So I said, sure, I've got this big social media following. Why not? I will do it myself. I won't have to give anybody else a cut other than the collaborators I work with. And I tried that, and it wound up working out spectacularly well.
Were there a lot of other people out there self-publishing that had reached the New York Times bestseller list?
I never technically reached the bestseller list. What I did was I got a rave review from Kakutani, who then put me on her 10 best of the year book list. And I think, frankly, the self-publishing nature of it helped in that regard. I know that she reads me, but I think she was also intrigued by the idea that I had done that. And if it had been a traditionally published book, I don't know that she would have necessarily put me on the top 10 list like that. But the day that initial review was published, I started getting calls, not only from my agent, but from all sorts of publishers who were like, wait a minute, why didn't you bring this to us a year ago? And in certain cases, I said, I did. You just didn't want it.
So then you become a popular guy.
Yeah. And so I started hearing from some of these people, and I decided I had taken the self-published version of it as far as it could go. The traditional publishers were interested. It would help get the book into many more places, physical bookstores, than it was now. It would be available in more countries, lots of other things that I couldn't do with the apparatus I'd set up. And so I did that, and that's worked out pretty well. And now Matt Seitz and I are working on another book for a traditional publisher. But I can imagine a circumstance where, down the road, I would try the self-publishing thing again, if all the different elements seemed right for it. In these particular cases, it worked out well that I hooked up with a mainstream guy.
Do you think that it helped having you mentioned your social media following before. Like, do you think that your origin on the web was one of the reasons why it succeeded?
I think that's part of it. I just think that a lot of people knew who I was and liked what I was doing, and this was a natural extension of what I was doing. It wasn't like, I had written a hard-boiled mystery novel and was trying to get people to buy it. This was me writing about all the shows that people love to read me writing about, and just going in depth and getting real insight from the creators of these shows, and in some cases talking about stuff that they had never, ever talked about before that candidly. The Lost guys in particular really opened up about how much they knew and when they knew it, which I thought was terrific. So it was just a natural extension of what I was doing and the following that I had. And I knew that I could go to, I think, what were like 40,000 Twitter followers at the time and say, hey, buy my book. And I knew that Simmons would have me on my podcast, which he did, and that would help. And I knew that I could, reach out to lots of other TV critics I knew and say, hey, would you be able to write a review of this? And they did. So I half of sales at this point is just being able to market yourself. And I knew how to do that already. I didn't need the publisher's team in that particular case to do it for me.
And so it was a do-it-yourself example for self-distribution in a lot of ways, because you had such a deep connection with your audience.
If someone is thinking of doing this and they're, you know, they've got like 5,000 Twitter followers, that would be a much tougher road to go down. But it's you got to start somewhere, and you got to try to build, and you have to know your audience and know what they want from you.
That's one of the reasons why I've started the podcast ahead of the book, is to get people on the show to talk about for book research, to, you know, open source the interviews. But also, I know how difficult it is to drop any brand or idea on the web and try to monetize that, whether it's music, book, film. And so if you can build a brand or an audience and get your ideas out, workshopping them, adding some value to people's lives in advance, then hopefully they'd be more likely to buy something from you.
Yeah, and I think that was – I think the self-publishing nature of it did appeal to the audience as well, because I would have people reach out to me and say, hey, I'm debating whether I want to buy the Kindle version or the print version. Which would you make more money on?
That's awesome.
There was a lot of goodwill I was getting at that time. It felt really nice.
This is almost like the crowdfunding mentality, but not crowdfunding, where people want to back your project and support you because they believe in who you are as a writer or creator.
Yeah, exactly. And they knew that I knew what I was doing, and it seemed exactly like the kind of book that somebody should write, and it wound up being me. So,
and how did you write the chapters in the sense of the research you did? Like for the Lost example you just said, I mean, you talked to the creators. Like how many interviews did you do total for the actual book and for each chapter?
A few dozen. I mean, it's primarily me speaking to each chapter is driven by interviews with the creator and or showrunner. Two of them didn't talk to me, Joss Whedon and Matt Weiner. In Weiner's case, I've interviewed him so many times that I was just able to take a lot of different things that he had said to me in the past, put it into that chapter. In Whedon's case, I just reached out to a lot of other people who'd written on Buffy and on Firefly and Angel and the other stuff he'd done, and basically got them to talk about Joss Whedon and talk about the show. And so that's probably the most sourced of any of the chapters. I had a limited amount of time in which to do it because I wanted it to be released by Thanksgiving of that year for the Christmas holiday shopping season. And I have this day job, which takes up a lot of time. So I did most of it in late summer and early fall of that year. And I interviewed anyone I could when I could. I reached out to any contacts. You know, I asked John Hamm, whom I've met a bunch of times on Mad Men. I said, hey, you want to talk to me for this? He said, sure. That worked out. And I was able to get it done by late October, and I was able to have it published within a couple of weeks, which is another really nice thing about the self-publishing apparatus. You know, if I had turned in a book to the publisher, it would have come out a year later.
Yes.
So
yes.
This had certain immediacy. I was able to change things. In the epilogue in particular, when talking about follow-up projects from various creators and, you know, like Sean Ryan, who did The Shield, had done a show that fall called Last Resort. When I interviewed him, it was still on the air by the time the book was coming out. It had been canceled, so I was able to change that at the last second. That would have been hard to do in another circumstance. So there was a real immediacy to it, too.
So that's great. So I'm going to go to publishers, you know, early January of this next year, and I'm going to self-publish it if it doesn't get any hooks, because at this point, I can't wait, and I love the fact that you're saying there's an immediacy to it, that you were able to write it up until the fall and have it come out by Thanksgiving.
Yes, that worked out very well. I've told people I know who have written traditionally published books, and they look at me like they can't believe that this is a thing that is possible. But technology makes it possible in the 21st century at this point.
Well, I'm writing about self-publishing in the book, so I may be quoting you. So this is why I love the podcast. And I know we only have a few more minutes. So what kind of advice do you have for someone who's an aspiring author or people that want to write books in general, now that you've, you know, been in this industry for so long and you're a surly veteran when it comes to writing?
I get asked for advice a lot on people who want to do things I do. And it's always tricky for me because I have been the beneficiary of a lot of sort of perfect timing in a lot of situations. Like I got to the Ledger, you know, at a time when this guy couldn't go to that press tour. I was at Penn at a time when we were starting to get internet accounts. I started doing the blogging at a time when it was early enough for that. So there's a lot of different things. The barrier for entry into a lot of what I do now is much higher. At least the barrier for entry, if you're going to make a living wage at it, is much higher. You know, I say to people a lot, they say, I want to do what you do. And I tell them, well, you need to be prepared for it to be a thing that you do for fun and not, you know, to pay your bills, because they're, you know, the media economy is changing so rapidly all the time that it's much harder and harder to break in and do this for a living. But I would say definitely find out what you're passionate about. Write about it as much as you possibly can, because that's the best way to get better at it. And try to, you know, put it out into the world through whatever means, start up a blog, start up a podcast, and hope that people find you, and do what you can to hustle along the way so that other people will bring attention to what you're doing. And that's the best you can do, but it has to be something that makes you happy to do in the first place. Otherwise, you know, go find something else.
Okay, cool. And, that's awesome. But one final question is, what about Better Call Saul? Have you seen that yet? What do you think it's going to be like?
I have not seen Better Call Saul. I'm probably going to see it sometime in the next few weeks, maybe in early January. I don't know. I'm hopeful, because I trust Vince Gilligan and Peter Gould, the two guys who are running it and who worked together on Breaking Bad. I don't know that a Saul spinoff is necessary. Saul was a nice little spice to Breaking Bad. I don't know if you can make him the main course, but you know, I'm gonna wait and see, because I trust Vince Gilligan. Vince Gilligan's a really smart guy, and at a certain point, I think if it wasn't working, he would have just backed away from it altogether. And instead, he went from a guy who was supposed to be consulting on the show to being actively involved as a showrunner on it. And because of that, I'm optimistic. But you know, we won't know until we see it.
Okay, that's awesome. So, HitFix.com, check out your podcast, your column. Well, I'm going to link to your old UPenn website in the description. Love that. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Hey, y'all. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. Alan was a phenomenal guest. I actually spoke with him earlier in the end of last year in 2014. It was a funny conversation because we only had a limited amount of time. It was about a half hour to speak, and I think we made the most of it. Alan is a writer and has a very efficient use of words, to say the least. And I got some great answers from him about the Bill Simmons bump, saying that, you know, when every time he went on Simmons' podcast, you get more Twitter followers. And also, I thought it was really fascinating that he self-published his book. When you think someone as big as Alan and as popular as him with What's Alan's Watching, that he would have such a following that a publisher would get it, that book would sell like gangbusters, but evidently not. He went the independent route, and then a publisher picked him up in the end, which I think is a great model for anyone who's an aspiring writer. And happy Alan stopped by. I am looking forward to writing a chapter about him in the book. So if you're interested in hearing more from that, shoot me a note and I can send you a summary of the chapter. I'm not ready to share the chapters just yet, but it's getting close. I put up a bookmark at influencereconomy.com/book to learn more about what I'm working on. And the launch date is December of this year. So it's happening soon. Got almost 6 chapters done so far. Cannot wait to get the rest finished and share this with the world. Been researching it for over 2 years now. And really, the book is a lifetime of work. You know, it's me working at startups and at Machinima, at State.com, at Digicim, which was acquired by Disney, and being on the front lines of the social media, YouTube, podcasting landscape, and just understanding the mechanics in a way that I felt like I didn't want to just build a business around the influencer economy. I wanted to actually historically create a archive or some sort of monument of sorts. I may be upselling it a bit. It's not a monument, but I think it's an artifact that you look back in time in 10 years and you say, this is what was happening right now at that moment when it was a transformational time in media. So Alan's part of the book. Also, Willie Geist, former guest of the show, is part of the book. Tucker Max, Veronica Belmont. I have a whole slew of people. So please email me, ryan@influencereconomy.com. If you're interested in helping me to edit the book, I'm looking for people from the crowd to help crowd edit the book. And always think that the more input you can get from people, the better off your product will be. So I'm down with the in-laws this week, hanging out. And Julia and I are going to go to the beach for some chicken in the pot. Heading over to Duke Zebert's.